Welcome to the Blue Stocking Circle podcast, Lady Nerds on Popular Culture. We're your hosts, B,
Chris Saul,
and Ashley.
This is episode 6, Pushing Daisies. In today's episode, we will be discussing the 2007 television series Pushing Daisies, a forensic fairy tale about life, death, life after death, love, murder, and pie. We'll share our origin stories, do some shipping, rant a bit, and share reading recommendations. We're going to focus on the series' first few episodes, but be aware the whole series is fair game for spoilers. There are only 22 episodes in total, so you can easily binge the series and return to this episode later if you want to remain unspoiled. Now, grab a slice of your favorite pie and let's dive in. The facts were these. Pushing Daisies premiered on October 3rd, 2007 to more buzz than a beehive. The pilot had leaked that summer to the surprise and delight of many, giving the series an adoring fanbase before it had even aired. It was strongly supported by both its studio, Warner Brothers, and its network, ABC, the latter of which had been seeking unique shows following the success of its mega hits Lost, Desperate Housewives, and Ugly Betty. Indeed, with its self-proclaimed Tim Burton meets Amelie aesthetic, quirky characters, mile-a-minute dialogue, platonic romance, cartoonish corpses, and occasional musical number, arguably nothing as unique as Pushing Daisies had ever been seen on television. Fortunately, the risk seemed to be rewarded. The pilot had nearly 13 million viewers, making it the most watched new series of the season, and the show was buoyed by universal critical acclaim. All was well, until tragedy struck in the form of the 2007 to 2008 writer strike. The show was halted after just 9 episodes. It returned almost a year later, but many viewers did not. After the second season's ratings plummeted, ABC gave a do not resuscitate order. Following a long hiatus, the series was allowed to say a few last words in the form of 3 final episodes and a last-minute addition to what became the series finale. Then the network finally pulled the plug. Pushing Daisies was Pushing Daisies after just 1 year, 36 weeks, 3 days, and 60 minutes, or 22 episodes. It is survived by an extensive list of awards and nominations, including 7 Emmys, and a devoted fanbase that is still mourning its untimely demise. For a show about revival, it's ironic Pushing Daisies has never gotten one. Plans for continuation as a comic book, movie, miniseries, even Broadway musical have never come to fruition. And so it seems Pushing Daisies' minute has run out, and the series will live on only in our hearts. Let us eulogize it with this episode, but first, our newbie Grisel will provide an obituary.
Pushing Daisies is the story of Ned the Pie Maker, who learns as a child that he has a particular gift, the ability to bring the dead back to life. He learns this in the worst way possible after the death of his dog, Digby. He soon learns that his gift comes with a cost, one life for another. He has 1 minute to return the dead before another life takes its place. He sets off a chain reaction that leads to his mother's death, the death of his childhood sweetheart's father, and his mother, again. All manner of guilt ensues, and Ned is taken away by a neglectful father, never to see his sweetheart again, until she turns up dead, and it's Ned's turn to ask why.
That is an excellent synopsis of Pushing Daisies.
I had to write it twice.
Well, it was worth it. All right, so with that synopsis out of the way, let's get to our origin stories. I'll start. And my Pushing Daisies origin story requires a confession that is still a source of great shame, which is that I did not watch the series when it originally aired. I do remember the original Pushing Daisies commercials and the buzz that surrounded the show before it premiered. Everything I saw and heard and read sounded amazing and something like I would absolutely love. And on top of that, I was already a fan of the creators. I had seen Wonder Falls when it aired in 2004, well, what little of it aired. And I was a fan of that series, it made a big impression on me. So I was interested in Brian Fuller's new show. And I also knew that the pilot had been directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, who also directed one of my favorite childhood movies, Men in Black and Don't Judge, Crystal. As well as the Addams Family movies, and more recently the TV show A Series of Unfortunate Events, all of which I love. The problem was that at the time, there was a series of unfortunate events in my own life, and I couldn't bring myself to watch a show about death, no matter how quirky and cute it was. But I kept the show in the back of my mind, and in 2013, I finally treated myself to the first season on DVD. I adored it immediately from the first episode, bought the second season right after I finished the first one, and have spent the last 5 years telling everyone I know to watch the show, as you two are well aware.
This is totally true.
So my origin story is kind of a little like yours in that I remember hearing about the show when it came out. I remember being intrigued by the trailers. And then when we were talking about it, I actually remember having, vaguely anyway, remember having a conversation about someone who had seen the first episode and they liked it. I can't remember why I didn't watch it, but it's had a place on the to watch list, you know, that everyone has in their mind for years. And I've heard it mentioned on and off again, you know, in the past decade as one of those shows that was tragically canceled before its time. And that sounded interesting because, you know, as a Firefly fan, I sympathize with those types of shows. I never gotten around to actually sitting my butt down and watching it. So thank you, B, because now I can finally check this one off my list.
You're welcome. I was surprised by how much you knew about that pilot and first impressions.
I think it's because we had that conversation that you and I, me and this person that I can't remember, and it just like stuck in there somewhere. This is why I'm not better at math, because I remember really dumb things that like it doesn't matter to anyone.
Well, brains. So my short answer is B made me do it. I have absolutely zero knowledge before watching the show. I had no expectations. I knew the name. I sort of knew it was about death, but that's just because the title kind of gives that away. This was my first time diving into this world.
And you thought it was Dead Like Me.
And I thought it was Dead Like Me. It didn't come out around the same time.
A little bit maybe. Later. You could consider it a spin-off of Dead Like Me.
Okay. I haven't seen that one either.
Oh, you will. All right. So to make sure we're on the same page before we go any further, I wanted to clarify something. I only assigned the first three episodes for this podcast episode, but I saw references to later episodes in the Google Doc we were all working on. So what was the last episode you each saw?
I've seen the first four. I don't know the names, but the first four.
Only?
I know.
I just kept going. I'm halfway through season two.
What was the very last one you saw?
Clowns.
Oh, that's a good one.
I don't like clowns.
Then you really like that one.
You really like this one.
I don't like clowns.
Okay, so we're ready to start the discussion. But before we start discussing specific aspects of the show, I wanted to talk about sense and sensibility, or what you thought and how you felt about the show, at least the few episodes that you saw. As for me, as you know, this show is one of my happy places. It always puts me in a great mood. And I'm pretty sure that if someone looked into my brain and made a show out of what they found there, Pushing Daisies would be the product of that. And I don't have nostalgia goggles for this. I think it's a generally great show. But I want to hear from the newbies.
As I said, I had never seen nor heard about the show before B told me about it, so I had no idea what I was getting into other than a slight suspicion that there might be singing because of Kristen Chenoweth. Also bright colors and stylized narration because B compared it to Amelie. So I was absolutely not prepared to be charmed within the first 5 seconds, and then horrified because of the dog, and then charmed again because that dog, again, is just like, that is unexpected, that hurt. But it totally worked and I was hooked from the beginning.
I don't know if it worked for me because I saw it and I was like, I've only seen 5 seconds. Yes. I can't turn it off. I was given an assignment, but I thought about it.
What just happened?
Yeah, exactly. It took me 2.5 episodes to decide whether or not I liked it. And that's very weird. It's never happened to me before. Normally I'll watch something and yes, it's great. No, it's bad. Or even, I kind of like it, but kind of don't. But I know where I felt. For the life of me, I could not figure out what I thought about the show. I could not decide. It was so weird. It's never happened before. I'm like, okay, you know what? Let me keep watching. I did not care either way. If you had stopped me, okay. And if you made me keep watching with a gun to my head, okay. I did not care. So I keep watching and I get to the third episode. The whole setup happens. There's a, you know, a thing that happens. And then one of the characters says, oh, you better be playing. And like hauls butt out of the funeral home. It was amazing. The runaway, the setup, the delivery, the deadpan. Oh my God. It was the best thing. I paused. I actually hit pause so I could keep laughing because I could not stop myself. So by the time I'm ready, I've collected my thoughts, I hit play. I think maybe the very next scene or soon following that was a scene where a character grabs her chest as she runs down the stairs and out as she's trying to escape something. And that was just like the realest depiction of my real life that I've ever seen on TV. And then that kind of tipped me over into the, okay, this is kind of awesome.
I cannot express how relieved I am that you both like this show. Okay, so let's dive into our regular segments now. So as we all know very well by now, I don't like kissing books or movies or TV shows or towns, and this series is literally as far as you can get away from that. But it is an overtly romantic work, probably the most romantic of all the works I like, since the entire series hinges on the love between Ned and Chuck. So what do you think of this show?
So I know Ashley and I have differing opinions on this. When the show first started and I realized it was a childhood love story, I wasn't sure I was going to be convinced just because I have like feelings about that kind of relationship. The difficulties and their ability to touch, though, make it possible for them to have like a slow burn kind of love story when they're actually adults. So I do like that. It's not the instant I saw you across the hall and I fell in love and let's get married type of a love story. It's not a perfect shiny fairy tale. It's got elements of the mundane. It's got elements of the magical. And Ned is keeping a lot of secrets from Chuck, and that adds a different element to their relationship that I think allows it to grow more, especially as he has to deal with these feelings, as Chuck starts to discover that he's got these secrets. So I think that it grows as a more realistic love over time, but it does not start out that way.
Maybe just because I'm still in the starting out point, but I kind of didn't like it. I have this thing with childhood romances that I don't like, and I think that's kind of the selling point of the show. Like, you really have to believe in that.
It pushes it at the beginning of every episode. Yeah. That he's her childhood love.
And I find that really weird. Like, I get why Chuck and her role as, like, a de facto shut-in, because she's caring for her aunts, who are actual shut-ins, hasn't gone anywhere, hasn't met anyone, hasn't done anything. I get it. But I've always found the whole pining after someone you knew as a child thing weird. 20 years have passed since they met each other. Are you telling me that Ned's love when he was 9 is like so pure that it's blinded him to all other women? I get not wanting to tell Chuck things because, you know, you have certain secrets between you and her vis-a-vis like her dead father, but his gift wouldn't have precluded him from having normal relations with other women. And he tells Emerson about it, so it's not Emerson found him, but it's not like he couldn't share that. So the fact that in 20 years, he's almost 30, and in his head, this person that he knew when he was 9 is like the paragon of everything that he wants in a woman. It was hard for me to buy it. And I like that even at the beginning, you can kind of tell that Chuck cares about him, but it's not just out of, she doesn't love him out of gratitude. Mm-hmm. She is grateful for, you know, bringing him back to life.
She doesn't like fall into it of like, I owe you for bringing me back to life or something. So there's none of that, which is good.
Right. And I kind of get, okay, you know, like you have a crush on someone. It's very natural for Chuck to have a crush on someone that she had a crush on 20 years ago and is her Prince Charming now. But at least from Ned's perspective, I thought it was a little weird.
You're 2 episodes away from getting an answer to the question of his history. But on top of that, I think Chuck starts out as a symbol for him. He lost everything, and I mean everything, right after they split up in childhood. He lost his mother permanently. He lost his father, essentially. His father abandoned him. He lost his home. He basically kept Digby and nothing else. So now he gets something else from that happy moment in his life, and I get the sense that he's never been happy except in childhood because of all the things that happened right after that. He's carried the weight of this guilt that he killed someone, that he continues essentially having the responsibility of killing someone unintentionally all his life. If he touches his own dog, that's it. So I think that Chuck is a symbol of happiness and safety and joy. Not so much that he's carried this crush and this love all these years, but that she's something reassuring and he hasn't felt like that before. So she brings along with her everything that made him happy for the only time in his life.
I see that also, especially the further I got into the show, because also, like, if I had just watched the first 4 episodes, it doesn't develop Chuck's character that much in the very beginning of the show. It doesn't develop too much of Ned's background. And the more you learn about Ned, especially his relationship with, or non-relationship with his father, and it's kind of like a kid who was just abandoned. After his mother died, he's just on his own for the most part, and he doesn't have friends. Nobody likes him. Nobody cares about him. Nobody really talks. It's a sad story. Poor it's Ned. Almost like a Harry Potter story. Like, there were moments when I was like, this is a lot like Harry. They just need to stick him under the cupboard. Like, he's got this magical talent and nobody will talk to him. So, but it does develop. And I also think that, yes, Chuck is a symbol for him of a happy time, you know, living in Coeur d'Alene. I mean, heart of hearts.
Yes.
So I do like, it's a non-realistic romance in many ways, but at the same time, it has potential to develop in a nice, caring companionship.
Okay, so I'll keep watching. I'm still not sold on Ned and Chuck, but it sounds like I maybe...
I don't know if you will. I know you like realistic ships. We talked about that before. By realistic standards,
it's
I
not.
Find it's, issues
it's
with
It's very,
them.
Very creative, but it's not realistic.
No, Ned is a vortex of psychological issues, and he's got some traits that would be really creepy in reality. Mm-hmm. He's possessive, he's jealous, he's controlling. The narrator calls him out on it, other characters call him out on it.
And my thing is, okay, I get that Chuck can't go back to Coeur d'Alene because everyone there thinks she's dead, but this seems to be set like before the internet was a thing, so why couldn't she go somewhere else and have a new life? Why does she have to stay with Chuck? Especially if, okay, she wanted to travel and she goes on the
I've cruise. I've always thought that. Road trip.
Yeah.
Although she doesn't seem to know how to drive.
She doesn't know how to do anything.
No, she's very sheltered.
Bees. Well, okay, and fine. I get the bee shelter.
Hallucinogenic pies.
Oh, yeah. We can discuss the ethical implications of drugging your family members because that's a little weird. But yeah, my thing was, okay, she wants to travel. You know, I understand she has a crush on him, but why not use this opportunity? It's not like she couldn't, as she does, put on makeup and a big hat and big sunglasses and see things. And then, okay, come back and live in Ned's apartment, right?
She's in his apartment. I've always thought, why should she go out, explore the world like she says she wanted, and then after a while, it can be more logical that she misses him and her home and her aunts and she comes back. But at least she's traveled. Like, she lived her dream. Mm-hmm. She died doing this. At least she could have had a positive experience exploring the world and come back. It would make sense for her character, but that's not the route they chose to go. And there would be no show if Chuck got up and left and just never came back.
That's done.
So I don't think they work by realistic standards at all, Ashley. But by in-story standards, I let myself get swept up in the kissing monkeys and the bright colors and the happy music and the cute little holding their own hands.
And the wooden arm thing he's got.
Oh, for Digby. That broke my heart. I was like, poor Digby.
So I think they're adorable. And I don't think if you don't like them now, you probably won't like them later.
I just think that he needs to go to therapy and work out his issues.
I think they both need to go to therapy.
Before he jumps into a relationship with someone else, because I'm very much a believer in you need to be your own person and you need to be a whole person before you start a relationship. And I think Chuck needs to maybe go to therapy, but more see the world, especially as a shut-in, and then jump into a relationship.
I think these were two people who suffered in childhood and just became stuck there.
Yes. They have a very childlike mentality, both of them. But there's a third element to this equation. So let's talk about Olive. I'm going to call myself out this time. I know Olive's behavior crosses the line. I think the show plays it for laughs because this time it's a woman pursuing a man relentlessly in what I called Steve Urkel syndrome back in episode 3. She goes after Ned and she does not give up by any means at all. She does kiss him. She does grab him. She does constantly put his hands on her body. Ned is clearly uncomfortable whenever they're alone together and he's cowering from her. And the show treats it like a joke. It's this image of tall, lanky Lee Pace cowering from tiny Kristen Chenoweth, who looks to be about half his height. She has to stand on furniture just to look at him in the eye. So the show plays it for a laugh, and it disregards Ned's discomfort. It does follow up on certain more troubling aspects of their relationship. I'm going to spoil slightly, Ashley.
Go for it.
She does kiss him in a later episode. The episode after that is devoted to the ramifications of that kiss. His discomfort, what he's going to do. There's a question of whether he wants one woman to have and one woman to hold. But it's not treated as an issue of consent in any regard. Yeah. It's considered more as a love triangle issue. What are your thoughts? Having seen that episode?
So that episode is a turning point for Ned in particular and also for Chuck. And it is uncomfortable, but I feel like it does a good job, especially of dealing with some of the questions that Olive herself has to ask herself. You know, do I want to pursue this man who is clearly uninterested, who has made it clear that he's uninterested, who others have made clear is uninterested? She's like poking out of her window into his window to see what he does in the morning. Like, it's definitely like terrible, do not do this behavior. Mm-hmm. But I also like Olive's character a lot. And I don't like the love triangle element. I like that the show sort of deals with that though and tones that down later.
It won't go too into. But it's kind of a U-shaped curve.
Okay, so since we're in, because I feel like I have two different streams of thought about this, so I'll focus on the ship wars part of Olive's character and, you know, the love triangle thing. I hate that trope.
It's my least favorite trope.
I hate it, and I especially hate it when, I don't say it's realistic because in real life, how many times does that happen? But this is not a situation where, have you guys ever seen One Tree Hill?
No.
Oh.
I only watch things with monsters and magic.
Oh, I mean, this is not realistic at all. This is high school drama at its best on the CW. But the whole point of the first couple of seasons there was the main character, Lucas, was torn between two girls. And
well, it's every single young adult novel.
But I'm okay. Not okay with it.
I mean,
but
Peter Gale Katniss. Like, yes. But okay, what was up with that?
Something like that where you can see that she has some type of attraction towards, the one character has some type of attraction towards the two that are both in love with character X. Mm-hmm. Not that I like that, but that at least, okay, I can understand why there's a triangle because she or he can see a life with either one of the two possibilities. Ned is not interested.
At all.
He's very not interested. I was really annoyed. I feel like Olive just gives women a bad name everywhere. This is why we have, not we have a reputation, but this is why some women have a reputation as stage five clingers, because they act like this. I love that Emerson told Olive that to her face, like, you wasting your time, because he's over it. And I love that her reaction was like something to the effect of, I don't want the reality. Because that signaled to me that she knows that she's being ridiculous by loving someone who doesn't want her. But at the same time, why is she bothering? She's attractive. She's talented. She's determined. She would be a great catch for a ton of people. So I didn't like it. I didn't understand what it was meant to do. It was meant to showcase how great Ned is because women want him. And that's why Chuck should be happy to be with him. Didn't work for me. If it was meant to showcase the dangers of living like in a dream world instead of reality, as Ned and Chuck sometimes are in danger of doing, didn't work for me. I don't like pitting women against each other. I don't like at all her character in the love triangle bit. And then the feminist rant part of me, which is, if you switch the genders, I would have been flipping the tables, because I've been like, why are you making me watch a show where one of the main characters sexually assaults the other one?
Yes.
Or sexually harasses, I guess, is the better term here.
You can say assault at some point.
Okay, yeah, I haven't gotten to assault. I think the kissing thing would probably be sexual assault. Definitely, like, her standing in front of the table.
Even in the pilot, yeah.
You know, and putting his hands on, you know, her chest and being like, oh, don't you ever touch anyone? Does anyone touch you? It's weird to me that they do that so much with her. And I think it's true, recently they were playing it for laughs. But then that made me question a lot of my assumptions, because I didn't flip the tables. Why is it that when it's a woman doing this to a man?
It's a double standard. It's been a topic of conversation lately. There's a lot of instances of magical rape, and that's women committing sexual assault against men in shows recently. Grimm did it. Grimm had an instance where, I don't know if either of you saw that show.
No.
One of the characters was essentially a witch, and she magicked herself to be the girlfriend of the main character and slept with him.
There's a whole conversation about this involving...
Once Upon a Time?
Yes.
No, also Harry Potter. Because Voldemort's mother, like, did she, you know, she enchanted the father. They were together for a while. And she is essentially raping him.
She put a love potion,
Yeah, there's also, in Batman fandom, like, Talia rapes Batman, essentially. Because she has a baby that he doesn't know about. Because she drugs him.
It's a double standard. And it ties into this general societal belief that's related to toxic masculinity, in which men cannot be victims of sexual harassment and assault because men are supposed to want it all the time. And if they don't, there's something wrong with them. And Pushing Daisies falls into that trap, where several characters imply there's something wrong with Ned because he's not interested in a woman other than Chuck. So it is an issue in genre TV, and Pushing Daisies does not call that out, even though it mentions a lot of other issues like Ned's possessive behavior. The show never calls out Olive for her behavior.
She also does the thing that is also more common with male characters of, this person needs to be fixed. He doesn't touch anyone. He doesn't touch his dog. She's always asking, why don't you touch your dog? Why don't you touch this? So she assumes there's something wrong with him and that she is the savior who will fix him if he will touch her, which is very common in a lot of books and movies and shows where the male character thinks that he can somehow fix the frigid girl.
Which so we talked about.
That happens. And the love triangle also, there are some scenes where she is pitted against Chuck. She tries to undermine Chuck, and that just, you know, I hate that. I hate women being put against each other because there's no need for this.
Before we move on to the feminist rant, I do want to mention Emerson's role in The Ships.
I love Emerson.
I love Emerson.
He is the voice of reason in this whole love triangle mess. Capital V, capital R.
He is so fed up with it. He's fantastic.
He plays such a vital role because every time they get to the point where you just sick of all this sweetness between Ned and Chuck, he stops the action. He stops the dialogue. He points it out so that you never get overwhelmed by the sweetness.
He says something snarky and makes it all better.
Exactly. He tells Olive when what she's doing is wrong. He tells Ned when what he's doing crosses the line. He calls Ned a stalker.
I love it.
Which is true.
I love it. I love him so much. He might be my favorite character on the show.
So Emerson may not have a role in this love triangle, but he is essential to it.
Okay, so talking about Emerson, I have a feminist anti-rant. I love that Emerson's way of relaxing is knitting. Not only is that something that's very feminine, it's like old lady feminine, like only grannies and like lonely cat ladies knit. I love that not only does he knit and he has like no shame in it because he carries his knitting needles around with him.
He does it all the time.
It's a very practical idea.
It's very practical. I love that when he knits stuff, he not only knits, you know, like a little waistcoat and little, like money holders, he knits himself gun holsters. I thought that was such a great little thing of like, you know what? Why are we gendering certain activities? Go for it. You knit, man, if you want to knit. That's what relaxes you. I love it. That's just one of the reasons
That's one of my favorite things about him, too.
Yeah, he's just so much fun.
What about the needles?
I think I saw in the notes that we have plenty of feminist anti-rants. So there was something else about the hair you put.
I did love, oh yes, I had to put that in the notes. Chuck does not have perfect hair. And that's something that unless you yourself do not have perfect hair, I do not have perfect hair. My hair is frizzy and wavy and curly and it's a hot mess a lot of the time unless I spend 2 hours fixing it. So I notice in shows, oh, this character wakes up from bed in the morning and her hair has Veronica Lake curls. How did she do this? It's not realistic. And as we all know, I kind of like realism. So the fact that they let Chuck, who is the protagonist of the show, the female protagonist, not only have hair that's not always slicked back or perfectly curled, because sometimes it is just wavy and not a pretty wave, just kind of like a layer wave. It's frizzy. When she puts her hair up in a bun, you see the little hairs escaping all over the place. It's realistic. And I just appreciated that. Between that and holding your chest as you're running down the stairs, I was like, there has to be a woman somewhere on the show that is contributing, or Brian Fuller notices things. So yeah, the fact that, and she was running, and going down the stairs, you can lose an eye sometimes. So, you know, like, that is something that some of us suffer from. So the fact that Olive was holding them back and that Chuck cannot be bothered because you know what? She was dead. Now she's alive and she has better things to do with her time than spend 2 hours with a blow dryer and frizzies in the morning. I really appreciated that. It's one of those things that it would be so easy to slick her hair back and make it perfect. Yeah. And just the fact that it didn't, it's a very small thing, but it endeared me that much more to the show. So I was like, yes, I had to mention.
While we're on our anti-rant, my anti-rant is that despite his stalker tendencies and other questionable behaviors, I do like the portrayal of Ned as what is a very mild-mannered man who embraces traditionally female roles. He is a baker. He's less experienced, or so it's implied in the show, given his relationship. He's always full of doubt. He's constantly pining, not in an aggressive way. And I just kind of like that. He's nice.
Okay, but this might shift into the feminist rant part of it. Is he too nice? Like, is he a nice guy?
I don't think so. I think he's very insecure.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's going back to that childhood thing, not having any role models, not having anyone who loved him, mm-hmm. not having any sort of nurturing, really. I think he just doesn't know how to do this. And there's one scene, the baby birds.
Oh, that's
where
so sad.
It's like he's trying to do this kindness and it backfires so terribly. I think that's his relationship with Chuck. He's trying to do this kindness and he loves her and he doesn't know how to express that love.
I see.
And he's just nice, but not always good at it.
He's putting her in a gilded cage and he doesn't realize it.
Yes.
So he's taking away her freedom.
He totally has her on a pedestal.
Yes, absolutely. And he's trying to give her everything except her freedom.
Yes.
So he's just being very incompetent at being a kind, loving, supportive boyfriend.
Which actually, that does sound like it could be
Which
realistic.
Also, if you think about it, could just be what he wants for himself.
That's true.
Because he pretty much lost his home after his mother dies. He lost everything he knew. For him, maybe that's the ideal, having that sheltered, safe space. And he thinks that he's providing this for her, which is his dream.
No,
it's so tragic.
No, but I kind of like that. Like, I don't know if you guys have heard of the book. I think it's called Love Languages or something.
Oh, I've heard of it.
Seven Love Languages.
Or five.
Yeah, something like that.
So, in a nutshell, the book posits that people have different ways of communicating their loves.
I have heard of it, yeah.
Some people touch, words of affection, gifts, something else. And the whole point is that you need to be aware of that because if you're in a relationship with someone, you might have issues, not because you don't love each other, but because you don't speak the same language. So now I'm thinking maybe Chuck, this is kind of like you're saying what's going on with Chuck and Ned, that in Ned's head, love is expressed through security and giving her what he wants.
It's his whole thing. He opened the pie hole because pie made him feel safe and warm and loved. He said to himself, it's
a comfort food.
It reminded
him of his mother.
Yes. He wants to give that to everyone, that same comforting, loving feeling that he felt as a child and hasn't
felt
since.
Dead mothers.
Oh, dead mothers. But no, I this is kind of
every fairy tale.
I'm kind of opening up a little bit more towards Ned and Chuck if I have to look at it as they love each other, but they don't know how to express it because they need to go to therapy and
yes,
they're still
totally. These people are very disturbed.
They're still caught up in what they want, so they're projecting it onto the other person. Ooh, that's interesting.
As the show goes on, not to go back to our shipboard segment, but as the show goes on, this facade of a perfect fairy tale couple, Prince Charming and a Sleeping Beauty, it completely gets broken. And the show points out that it's a completely false illusion.
Yeah.
And you start seeing more and more the cracks in that relationship. And you see them talk about it, which is great. They realize they have to have these conversations. And then they do have these conversations.
And okay, I appreciate that, because one of my other feminist rant things was I hated the whole, oh, she looked at him and saw Prince Charming. And he looked at her and saw Snow White. And yes, that's beautiful if you're 12 and you're wearing braces and you're dreaming of getting married in a big white dress and you haven't had a real functioning relationship before. But in real life, like, if you look at Prince Charming, he's, like, kind of an idiot. Like, I don't want a Prince Charming. You want someone who listens to you and understands you and respects you, which is not really something that Prince Charming ever did. So
I'm going to bottle up my suspension of disbelief and give a little to you, Ashley. I think that's so cute. It doesn't matter. Oh, no. Whimsical fairy tale world. Can't you just suspend your disbelief? Like, when you watch Beauty and the Beast, can't you just realize, yes, this is Stockholm Syndrome and he's a horrifying person and she should never be with him, but look at the bright colors. And they look happily ever after.
I can do that because that's never going to happen in real life. I am in a fairy tale. I'm never going to meet a 7-foot-tall beast man thing. Well, I guess Pushing Daisies is not real life either, because...
No, it's a fairy tale. It is called the forensic fairy tale.
Okay. Because my argument was going to be, in real life, this relationship, if we can agree that someone could actually bring someone back from the dead and start a relationship there, that's not a healthy way to be. Like, you shouldn't look at her and see Snow White, because guess what? Snow White's prince knew nothing about her other than, oh, she had really cute hair and a cute face.
As the resident Beauty and the Beast person, the one thing about this show that reminded me of a fairy tale was Beauty and the Beast. Because, as in Beauty and the Beast, it takes time for them to really get to know each other as adults. They're locked away in this fantasy world, but they have to come to terms with it. Belle and Beast don't get along in the beginning. They have to come to terms with it.
So while we're talking about fairy tales and dreams and all these ideas together, let's talk about the manic pixie dream girl trope. That comes up a lot when we discuss Pushing Daisies. I saw it mentioned in the notes as well. Just to review, the term manic pixie dream girl was coined by Nathan Rabin in his 2007 review of the film Elizabethtown and was disowned by him in a 2014 Salon article. He originally meant it as a shorthand for a type of character who's always female and who is whimsical and childlike and whose function is to give her love interest, who is usually a melancholic white male protagonist, a greater appreciation of life. The problem with this trope is that this person has no inner life herself and ultimately serves as a prop, much like a puppy or a kitten or a bowl of ice cream with rainbow sprinkles. You can probably think of several characters like this, from Katharine Hepburn's Susan in 1938's Bringing Up Baby to many roles played by Zooey Deschanel in recent years. It's a long-standing trope. The issue is that, as Nabeen writes in his 2014 article, the term has taken on a sexist connotation like Mary Sue, used to dismiss any quirky female character. And the problem is not the quirkiness. Some of us are just naturally perky and quirky girls. The problem arises when these characters aren't given any attributes beyond their quirkiness. They have no personalities, no ambitions, and no autonomy. When a quirky woman in a work of fiction seems to have no goals beyond making a mopey man happy, that's when the character goes wrong, and it's due to bad writing. And I'm bringing this up because, again, Chuck is often called a manic pixie dream girl. Her nickname in the fandom is Manic Pixie Dead Girl. She is indeed whimsical and childlike. She is indeed a love interest of a melancholic, mopey white male protagonist to whom she gives a greater appreciation of life. The question is therefore, does Chuck have an inner life, her own ambitions, and her own autonomy? What do you think?
So I say yes. If you're only looking at it at the surface and you're seeing Chuck as, you know, the traditional manic pixie dream girl who is the woman who comes in and is this charming foil for the male protagonist, then you are seeing that, but you need to look beyond that to see the real character. Unlike the traditional manic pixie dream girl, Chuck develops. Her character goes beyond just being a tool for Ned's personal growth, which is what it seems to be in the first couple of episodes. But as the show develops, so does Chuck's persona. She has an established personality. She has goals. She wants to make her aunts happy. She wants to develop a friendship with Olive, even with strange, creepy sewer man. She has hobbies. She wants to make pie cups. Like, she starts to develop and have these goals and dreams outside of what Ned wants. And as you get into the second season in particular, that becomes even more established, where she wants to exist outside of Ned. If this were just a traditional manic pixie dream girl role, she would be nothing more than the cute girl who floats around the pie hole and says quippy things and does nothing else but follow along in Ned's footsteps.
I couldn't have said that better myself, Grissel. I can see from the first few episodes how you could think that. She doesn't seem to have much of a role beyond quirky childhood love, who's going to make Ned happy again. But after those first few episodes, she increasingly exerts her independence. She always pushes back right from the start. And by season two, like you said, and this is a slight spoiler, actually, she fully takes control of her independence. Mm-hmm. She does what she wants, And she tells Ned he's going to have to get used to it.
Yeah,
because that's what she wants.
She comes to exist outside of him. She's a fully realized character. She's not flat by the end of the first season. And there's one scene where Ned confesses his deep, dark secret. And she does tell him that she does have to hate him a little bit for it. So she doesn't just forgive him. She knows that what he did caused her pain and harm. And she has to come to terms with that without just blindly forgiving him and going along with it and being like, oh, but life goes on. Happy, joy, joy. Like, she's not that.
She loves him, but she doesn't live for him.
Yeah.
And even, you know, for being the one that was very, like, not anti-Ned and Chuck, but kind of Ned and Chuck, I never really saw her as a manic pixie dream girl, even in the episodes that I've seen. I get that she's quirky and I get that she's whimsical, sore, all of them. But even at the very beginning, I think, like Griselle said, you see she's baking the pies for her aunts. And you can talk about the Cathartic Corner because you cannot spike
flipping drugs.
Yes, that is so, so very wrong. But, and she doesn't tell Ned about it because when Ned comes down and says, like, oh, there's a pie in the oven, she's like, oh, yeah, I was just playing.
Practicing.
Yeah, or practicing. So even at the very beginning, she's keeping things from him. Not that keeping secrets is good, but she's kind of developing her own life and her own reasons for doing things very early on. So I like that she develops even more of a sense of independence. And I can see how she could, on the surface, fit into that manic pixie dream girl template. But I think the show did a good job of, even if you do think that, you don't stay in that way. Because I didn't think that even watching 4 episodes. I could tell that she was going to do more and more on her own.
Glad to hear that. I have no feminist rant. I love the show. So let's move on to Catharsis Corner. You can talk about the ethics of baking pies laced homeopathic medicine.
You cannot do this. Like, I understand, I come from a very specific background. I have family and friends who work in the healthcare industry. You are not supposed to give your family members Tylenol if you are a medical professional. I get that she is not, but where does she think that she can dose them with drugs? Does she know their medical history? She probably does, when I'm thinking about it.
She probably does.
She probably does. But have they consented? Maybe they don't want.
They definitely do not.
She also makes Olive an accomplice to a crime.
Yes.
Okay, but Olive didn't know. So
exactly.
She can't be tried under RICO because she doesn't know that she's doing the thing. You have to know that you're committing a crime.
She unwittingly turns Olive into an accomplice in baking the pies. And Olive thinks it's vanilla.
Yes.
They double dose.
She tells her it's vanilla and Olive like dumps the entire thing. And she's like, more vanilla. This doesn't taste like vanilla.
She could have killed her aunts. She could have given them any type of reaction.
Lily has a memorable reaction.
Yeah,
yes,
that's the best.
And these, you're giving your aunts drugs that you don't know how they're going to react because you're not around to watch them. So you don't know if you have to regulate the dosage of it. Oh, I'm freaking out so much right now.
Hallucinogenic pies.
And those are probably not FDA approved.
No. Who knows what's in that?
That is a very good point. Don't bake things into pies.
Don't give people drugs. And this is another Catharsis Corner. It's a little thing. But I kind of understand where Emerson is coming from. I don't know, like, what the contractual agreement between him and Ned was, but they had a working relationship and they expected it to go a certain way. So the fact that Chuck shows up and then Ned all of a sudden is like, she can come along on all of our things. And we're already trying to lie to the coroner or the medical examiner, whoever that older guy sitting there is. And it's bad enough that the two of us have to lie to him and they have a different story every episode, which is actually kind of funny. But now we have a third person, so the story has to be even more elaborate because three of us are trying to trick the old guy. And it's kind of like,
it only gets better when there are nuns.
That was kind of the Catharsis Corner for me. Like, Ned is not always the most ethically responsible when it comes to employment. And the fact that, like, Emerson, I think, was getting, like, the shorter end of the stick. And he's my favorite character, so I felt for him. Just a little. It wasn't a big one, but it was, like, poor Emerson. The man just wants to go in, talk to the corpse, get his money. He has bills to pay. This is a job that he's doing. If Ned doesn't want to do it anymore, fine, but let's have a discussion and let's fully terminate the contract in writing and go on our separate ways.
Valid point.
I'm guessing B doesn't have any.
Oh, I have a major Catharsis Corner rant.
Go for it.
Which is that the series was canceled on a cliffhanger and has never been revived.
Oh, even that's the worst, really?
The whole point of the series is that dead things should get revived, at least briefly, for some sense of resolution.
Nothing, like, not even like a comic, like in Buffy season 8?
They had advance warning they were going to be canceled. The series just wasn't picked up after the 13 episode renewal for season 2. So they had advance warning of several weeks or maybe months, and they added a little 5-minute or so epilogue to the final episode that gave some characters a sense of closure, but didn't give other characters a sense of closure. I'm okay with the ending, but I still want more of Pushing Daisies because I love this world so much, and I wasn't happy with some of the endings that some of the characters got. I know we've discussed her flaws, but I love Olive. She's my favorite character, and I think it's a flawless performance by Kristen Chenoweth that rightfully earned her an Emmy. I don't like her ending at all. This isn't going to mean anything to either of you yet, but there's a character called Randy Mann who's tied up in her ending in some way, and I despise that character. Olive deserved better. Alfredo should have come back. I know that was a plan for season 2 when it fell through, but they could have added that to the epilogue. They didn't actually need the actor for the epilogue. They could have done it in voiceover, thanks to the narrator.
That makes me sad that he doesn't come back, because I actually really liked him. He fixed the Nespresso maker for her.
He does come back in season 1, after what you've seen. He just didn't come back for season 2.
Oh, I kind of like them. Like, and they set it up. Yeah, I guess you're right, because they set up as, oh, Olive was pining over Ned and she couldn't see. I think the narrator says something to that effect.
He was being built up as her love interest, and when the writer's strike happened, he couldn't come back for that second season, even though he was meant to be the love interest in the second season. If you go to the DVD special features to talk about the plan. And Olive was one waitress who did not want her own restaurant. That ending made no sense for her. She didn't care about food. She cared about Ned. What she did seem to enjoy and she was really good at was being a private investigator, so I think she should have ended working with Emerson. Snook and Cod PIs, or Cod and Snook PIs, however they want to order that, and it could have been a glorious spinoff, even if the main show was cancelled, and I will forever be upset that we never got to see more of Emerson and Olive working together. I'm going to spoil you guys slightly. He made the offer. So those cards were on the table. They could have picked it up and run away with that idea.
I would watch that.
Yes. I will say that I have not gotten to that part yet, but reading the name Randy Mann, I'm just like...
Already, what? I'm like, that doesn't sound like a good beginning for
Imagine
this person.
A more pathetic Ned.
Oh. Well, that just, no. Do not like. Expect not to like.
I'm sorry if Randy has fans out there. I am not one of them. He's one of my only complaints about the series.
Okay, so I don't have a catharsis. I have to say that for all my feminist ranting.
Wait. Repeat that.
I do not have a catharsis. I do not need to vent any
what is
negative
up with this
feelings.
Show?
I love the sappy, syrupy love story, and I really loved Olive's over-dramatized pining, even when she was weird and stalky, because it was funny. That's troubling, but I loved it. She's so extra, it just works so well for her character, and anything that leads to a spontaneous musical number totally gets an A in my book, so blame it on my Gemini nature. I am of two minds on the troubling things happening in this series.
Is this when I confess that I put homeopathic mood enhancers in the pie we just ate?
I thought something, Tina.
Wow, okay, I feel like I want to frame this, but I can't because it's audio.
You can save this clip forever.
You can do one of those things where you get, like, they can print out the audio, like the sound waves, and normally it's like, oh, I love you, or whatever, but...
It's Brissell like, oh, saying she's Brissell, got no rant.
I have no rant.
Or right. You could just play it every time I do rant about something, be like, remember that time?
I feel very encouraged now, so let's just go straight into those stock ratings. Grisel, let's start with you as the pointed newbie and person who had no catharsis corner rant.
I give it a 5! For sheer delight, it was wonderful. I started watching it and was like, I don't know if I'm going to have time to watch all these before we record. And I was like, I will make the time.
The blood has left my face. I never thought I would see the elusive Grisel 5.
I give it a 5. I was waiting to be able to say this.
Oh, wow. I'm glad this is being recorded because I have never been more surprised in my life.
For posterity.
Okay, I'm not going to give it a 5. I'm going to give it a 4.
That's so high praise.
That's because I like it. I would recommend it.
You're only 4 shows in?
The only reason I don't give it a 5 is because for me, I really liked it. I don't know that I would rewatch it. And for me, my 5s, I think, have to be things that I would...
Your 5 lies.
I would totally rewatch.
I do rewatch. This is my 3rd time going through the whole series.
But high 4, like not, you know, 4.1, like a strong, solid 4.7. Like, this is a good 4.
Wow. I'm going to give it a 4.5, just because I feel if we had stronger sense of resolution, it would get to that 5. But I do need that more solid ending to go for the full 5. Nonetheless, do you realize what this means?
This is the highest rated.
It's the highest rated.
This beat Jane Austen. We can think of no higher praise. Go watch Pushing Daisies right now. This time I have reading, listening, and viewing recommendations. So let's go ahead and start. I'll begin with the books, and first up is a novel that has haunted me since I read it years ago, and that's The Boy Detective Fails by Jill Menno. It's based on the premise of what if an Encyclopedia Brown-like child detective grew up, what if his sidekick and sister Ala Sally killed herself when she was a teenager, and what if he was so consumed by this one mystery that he could never solve that he wound up in a psychiatric hospital until he was 30. The characters in this book are just as quirky as those in Pushing Daisies, and I really think Ned and Billy are kindred spirits. It's more melancholic than comedic, but it is a good match for the show in my opinion. Although it's not quite the same in tone, if you want another taste of that crime and sugar mix, try True Confections by Katherine Webber, a continent and generation-spanning novel about marriage, divorce, candy, and arson. It makes a really good pairing, especially with Episode 8, Bittersweets, and also the episode Comfort Foods from Season 2. Lastly, and not just because of the title, I also have to mention The Sweetness at the Bottom of the Pie by Alan Bradley, the first book in the Flavia Deleuze cozy mystery series about a precocious preteen girl in post-war Britain who engages in private investigation and chemistry in her spare time, as one does. For the listening recs, play the American version of the Harry Potter audiobooks whenever you miss the narrator so you can once more luxuriate in Jim Dale's voice. If you're musically inclined, check out the Australian artist Lenko, whose songs and videos sound and look like what Chuck would do if she became a musician all of a sudden. You can begin with the video for her first single, the 2008 song The Show, which you have undoubtedly heard somewhere. For the viewing recs, the obvious starting point is the 2001 French film Amélie, which Brian Fuller has repeatedly stated was one of his inspirations for Pushing Daisies, and which we are definitely going to discuss in a future episode, so you're warned. If you want to see more of Lee Pace in extremely stylized works, watch the 2006 film The Fall, where he plays a heartbroken 1910 stuntman who tells a fantasy story to an adorable little girl with a broken arm while they're both hospitalized. The movie alternates between the hospital and the fantasy world the patients co-create, sort of like The Princess Bride, but the fantasy world's visuals in this movie have no comparison. I don't know if it's good, but it's amazing. If your favorite aspect of Pushing Daisies is the romance, watch another 2006 film, Penelope, starring Christina Ricci and James McAvoy, which has a look and feel similar to the show. It's a modern fairy tale about a young woman cursed with a pig nose, and that is a literal statement, who must find love to break the spell, kind of a gender flip Beauty and the Beast retelling.
And I got major Penelope vibes when I was watching this
show. So did I, yeah.
Obviously, I'm going to very highly recommend the current television series, The Good Place. Everyone who knows me, starting with you two, is tired of hearing me talk about it, so I'm just going to refer
every
you
time.
Just going to refer you to Minisode 1.5 if you want to hear me extol its virtues. I will only say here that I think it's the closest we'll ever get to more Pushing Daisies, and my constant promotion of the series is my penance for not having seen Pushing Daisies when it aired. Last but not least, you should of course check out Brian Fuller's other series. All of them have been abruptly cancelled, but if you can live with the so-called finale of this show, you'll be fine with the others. For Pushing Daisies fans, I especially recommend Dead Like Me, his 2003 series about George, a cynical teen girl who becomes a Grim Reaper after her death. And I also recommend Wonderfalls, his 2004 series about Jay, a cynical 20-something woman, who one day starts receiving instructions from inanimate objects. The character of Ned the Necromancer, our Ned, was originally conceived as a Dead Like Me character, who would have been a foil and love interest for George in the show's second season, but Brian Fuller left that series before that could air. And Wonderfalls stars Lee Pace as Jay's brother, so there are your Pushing Daisies connections if you need them.
So my first thought upon starting the show was that this is every cozy mystery slash urban fantasy about a baker rolled into one, and with occasional musical numbers for fun. So it isn't too hard to come up with a million and one book recommendations of that genre. However, I will stick to just one, and that is the one that could not be silenced as I was watching the show. I just kept coming back to this one book, and that was Robin McKinley's Sunshine, an urban fantasy about a baker who meets a vampire and discovers her own magical power of touch. It's been a while since I've read this book, but Pushing Daisies really made me want to go back and revisit that story.
That's a really good book and a really good recommendation, and I didn't think of the connection until you pointed it out.
But it's so obvious. You said it, and I was like, duh, that has to be what people read after watching it.
Well, thank you. So, as a total side note, just because as the series developed, this is the other one that came to mind, is Chobits, which is a manga by the female mangaka group Clamp. And that is about a guy who brings a robot to life. Sound familiar? And it is very silly, occasionally a little pervy, but it has some serious musings on life and humanity.
Okay, well, like I said, Sunshine definitely fits with it. Given the rapid-fire dialogue, the witty repartee, and the host of colorful and quirky and whimsical characters, I was put in mind of Gilmore Girls, the CW-WB show that ran from 2000 to 2007 and recently enjoyed a one-off revival on Netflix. Just fair warning, season 7 of Gilmore Girls is not all that great, and the revival, I think, is not all that great. So if you're going to watch it, stick to the earlier high school seasons. I was also reminded of the book Mrs. Pettigrew Lives for a Day, which is another modern-day fairy tale. This one's about Cinderella, and the protagonist, middle-aged Mrs. Pettigrew, metaphorically comes back to life after spending years in drudgery. The light-hearted, whimsical, fantastical feel is similar, I think, to Pushing Daisies. And as an added bonus, they made a movie adaptation of it, which is also very good, and the movie stars Lee Pace. So if you need more Lee Pace in your life,
who doesn't?
Watch the movie. And I've only seen a couple of episodes of Jane the Virgin, but what I've seen is excellent, and it's got a stylized color palette like Pushing Daisies and a great narrator who has thoughts about what's going on as he's narrating, and I really appreciate that. And I think he's a great successor to Jim Dale, so I would also recommend Jane the Virgin.
I've seen all of Jane the Virgin, and I very strongly recommend season one of the show.
Fair. I've only seen season one, so that's totally fine with me.
It is an excellent match to Pushing Daisies, so I'm glad you pointed it out, Ashley. Also, everyone also needs more Rogelio de la Vega in their lives.
So true. He's so amazing.
I want to end this segment with a selfish plea for your reading and viewing recs. We all liked the show, which has never happened before and will never happen again. So give us more of this genre that we can all like together. Tell us at Blue Sock Circle. That concludes this episode of the Blue Stocking Circle podcast. For the show notes, visit thebluestockingcircle.com. Find us on Twitter, Tumblr, Instagram, Pinterest, and pretty much everywhere at Blue Sox Circle. That's Blue, S-O-X, Circle. Email us at thebluestockingcircle@gmail.com and join the conversation. You can also find us on Apple Podcasts and Google Play, so please rate, review, and subscribe to help us grow.
Cheers!
For the feminist rant, I have an anti-feminist rant, which is that I love that Emerson's way of relaxing of...
You don't have an anti-feminist rant, you have a feminist anti-rant.
Feminist anti-rant.